The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Presentations and discussions with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Frank Aquila of Sullivan & Cromwell on top issues to spot in a public company merger agreement. The opinions expressed by guests interviewed on LexisNexis Legal Podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. Frank Aquila is a partner in the Sullivan & Cromwell LLP Mergers and Acquisitions Group. His practice focuses on mergers, acquisitions, strategic alliances, and corporate governance matters for large multinational corporations. Mr. Aquila received his JD degree from Brooklyn Law School and received a Burton Award for Legal Achievement in 2005. He's recently written the Emerging Issues Analysis, Speed Reading, 10 Issues to Spot in a Public Company Merger Agreement, available from LexisNexis. Mr. Aquila, thank you. Good to have you as part of this LexisNexis Legal Podcast.
Good to be with you today as well.
10 Issues to Spot in a Public Company Merger Agreement. Talk about the article. What was the basis for this?
The reason that Melissa Stoyer, my partner, and I put this article together is, at least from my own background, I've been doing this for over 25 years. And in the early to mid-80s, if you looked at a public company merger agreement, it was basically anywhere from 12 to 20 pages. Today, even bare bones public company merger agreements are 60 pages and some run 100 pages. And by the way, I should say, although the article talks about merger agreements and public company merger agreements, the reality is that most of the issues that we talk about in the article are really issues you would have in any significant M&A transaction. But the reason that we thought about writing this was that today it used to be, the package arrived overnight or a messenger delivered it. Now the agreement gets sent to you by email. Everybody has it. And of course, the client, the board of directors, the bankers, they want to know right away, what are the big issues? Is this a deal that we can do? Are the gaps, things that we can bridge in negotiation. So here you have longer, more complex agreements and provisions. And at the same time, because of the world that we live in today, clients expect much quicker analysis. So what we find is that in doing that, we have to work with our colleagues here that when the agreement comes in, okay, what are we going to be looking at? What are the key issues, and how do we get in a bullet point, outline fashion, the headlines out so people can start thinking about those issues? And that really is the genesis of this article. The one thing I would say is we've focused on the quote-unquote top 10 issues. However, as you know, and everybody who's listening to this knows, every single transaction is different. So there are probably individual issues that would be, in some cases, even number one on the list, but they're particular to that deal. The premise of the article is that all other things being equal, these are going to be the big issues that you need to be looking at, thinking about, and ultimately dealing with in negotiation of virtually every transaction.
And I would imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, but many of these 10 probably somehow involve price, money, or how certain the deal could actually be.
Clearly, at the end of the day, what does the client, what does the board want to do? They want to know that if they enter into this agreement, that their shareholders are going to get the value that's been agreed upon and that the deal is going to close. So clearly, the consideration that the shareholders are going to get and the certainty is going to be crucial. Now, most people say, well, why is the consideration, why is the value going to be in question? The reason is twofold. One, is how it's defined in the agreement. You know, if it's cash and it's $10 a share and there's no adjustments, well, that's pretty straightforward. If, on the other hand, it's $10 a share, but we're going to allow, you know, dividends between signing and closing, or we're going to deduct dividends if they get paid between signing and closing, that does affect it. More importantly, if it's share consideration or part share consideration, you have to look at what the adjustments are. And those are the type of things that we talk about and that you would look at very quickly. Going back to, you know, an all-cash deal, if you're selling to a buyer that has $20 billion in cash on their balance sheet and your deal is a fraction of that, or if it's a company that has very good line of credit and they don't have to go out and do any special financing for the transaction, in that situation, you're not really concerned about the financing. Assuming all the closing conditions are met, you're going to get the closing and they're going to be, as we call it, money good. They're going to have the cash. However, and particularly as we recall from the last couple of years, financing is often required in these transactions, and financing, although it may be available today or we think it's available today, when time comes for closing, you're not going to be able to get that financing. So the important thing to look at in the agreement, if there is some sort of concern over financing, is there a financing condition, meaning can the buyer walk away if the financing isn't available? Is there a reverse break fee, meaning does the buyer have to pay you a certain amount of money if the financing isn't available? Do you have the right of specific performance, meaning are you able to go to a court and say to that court, we have a deal, the lack of financing is their problem? So essentially what you're looking at when you look at the financing provisions, and they may be in a variety of places in the agreement, there might be a representation on financing, there might be a closing condition on financing, there might be a covenant on financing, there might be termination provisions. That's why, as I say, these agreements are very complex and you really need to look at all the provisions. But essentially what you're looking at in terms of financing is, what is the level of effort that the buyer has to achieve? Is it, you know, their problem? Do they have to use best efforts? Do they have to use reasonable efforts? Whatever it may be. And then what are the consequences of their failure to obtain financing? So those are the things that you would be looking at there.
How about social issues? Are social issues an important consideration in these as well?
Yes, and social issues are important on two levels. One is, of course, we recently saw the Continental United combination. You could see that it was a very, very artfully crafted package. The name of the airline is going to be United. The look and colors of the airline are going to be the old Continental logo and colors and whatever. The headquarters of the company is going to be in Chicago. The name is going to be in Chicago. But the CEO is going to be the old Continental CEO. The board, it's split evenly between the two companies, and then there's two people on the board from the unions. That is a very good example of what are the social issues. Board composition, senior management, name, headquarters, things like that. Why is that important? Well, to the extent that one of the companies or both of the shareholders of the companies are going to get stock in the ongoing entity, it's important to understand how is that company going to be managed. And I would say that if it's a stock-for-stock merger and there's a lot of upside, if I'm not confident that the management and the board of that combined company can achieve what that combined entity is capable of, then I'm not going to be supportive of that transaction. So social issues often are thought about, well, that, you know, they're social issues, they're really not important. But I think one of the things that you look at studies of mergers and successful mergers and failed mergers is, you know, usually the combination is good, usually the price was right. It was execution post-closing. So the social issues are more important than ever. The board should be focused on the social issues, and it's one of the things you want to look at very quickly, because you might be able to agree on price. You might be able to agree on the closing conditions. You might not be able to agree on who's going to be the CEO or who's going to be the chair of the board.
You know that material adverse effect provisions have always been a hot topic for M&A practitioners. Can you expand on that in this situation? They made your list of issues to spot.
Well, I think one of the things we've seen, and this is certainly one of the major pieces of litigation that arose 2007, 2008, 2009, is buyers signed up deals. Essentially, the financial system was near to collapse. The economy cratered, and a number of buyers said, there's been a material adverse change, there's a material adverse effect. This company is no longer worth what the company was before. The interesting thing, and this has been fairly consistent, Delaware, New York, the other states that have looked at it, by and large, it is extraordinarily difficult to get out of a deal based upon a material adverse effect. What the courts are saying is that you need to show that there really has been a specific effect on the target company, on the company being sold or being acquired, that goes beyond general economic or market conditions. It's the proverbial, the one plant that the company has burns to the ground. I think we all would say, if that plant is irreplaceable, it's the only plant, well, you know what? That company has probably just had a material adverse effect. The fact that there's an economic cycle, and by the time you get to closing, the economy is not doing as well, and therefore the target company is not doing as well as it was before, that's probably not a material adverse effect. So what that means is that when you look at material adverse change, material adverse effect, you have to look very, very specifically at what, in fact, the provisions call for, how specific they are. What I've always said to clients is, don't just rely on a general MAE clause. Don't rely on a general material adverse change clause. Be very specific. If you want to walk away if revenues in a quarter drop by 5% or more, let's be specific about it. If you want to walk away, if this happens or that happens, be specific about it. You may have a general MAE out, but litigation history has shown that that is very, very difficult.
I imagine another very important issue would be, as you refer to them, the hell or high water provisions, those drop-dead dates.
Yes, those are particularly important in situations where you have either an antitrust approval, an EU competition law approval, FCC, whatever it may be. When you know that there's either potential regulatory issues or, you know, actual issues that you're going to have to deal with the regulators, it's going to take you a period of time to do it. There's two things you want to be looking at. One is, what is the level of requirement? What does the buyer have to do? Does the buyer have to sell a plant? Does it have to divest certain businesses? Does it have to, in the hell and high water circumstance, do whatever they need to do to satisfy the government? And then the second element of that is, what period of time do they have to do it in? Can you walk away in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months? Can they walk away at a certain period of time? So these often are a balance and a trade-off. The stronger the commitment the buyer is prepared to give that they will do what they need to do to get the regulatory approval, the longer the seller is going to be prepared to give the buyer to get it done. Because if the buyer is willing to accept the pain of satisfying the regulators, you want to give them as much time as possible to do that, because otherwise they really have, you know, in effect, two guns pointed to their head. One is the time clock, and the other is the demands of the government regulators.
We've touched on a number of the issues you point out in the article. You highlight 10 in all. And these agreements are obviously very complex documents with numerous layers of legal and business aspects to them. What advice do you have for other practitioners when looking at these agreements?
I think the key thing is that even before the agreement arrives, have a conversation with your client, understand what your client's objectives are in the transaction, and usually this is a conversation that you're going to have not only with the legal people at your client, but also the business people at your client. And what you're going to want to do is understand what the points of sensitivity are, what their objectives are, and is certainty more important than timing? Is timing more important than certainty? Is price more important than timing or certainty? So you want to understand their objectives. You want to understand to what extent there are issues between the two companies, either from a commercial perspective, a competitive perspective, a regulatory perspective, that they want to see reflected in the document. The more you understand about your client, the party on the other side, their industry, and the dynamics of the transaction, the easier it is for you to go into that agreement and understand what the real pressure points. Because as I said, these 10 tend to be the ones that pop up in agreement after agreement, but some of them are number one on the list in certain deals. Sometimes they're number 10 on a list in another deal, and sometimes there's an issue that we don't even touch on here that's very specific to that company and that transaction that you want to be dealing with maybe as issue number one, but if not issue number one, certainly is one of the key issues.
It all depends on the facts of that particular situation in that case.
You said it well. You said it accurately.
The Emerging Issues Analysis Speed Reading, 10 Issues to Spot in a Public Company Merger Agreement. Frank Aquila, Sullivan and Cromwell, thank you very much for talking about some of these issues, touching on a number of them that you mentioned in the article, which is available from LexisNexis, by the way. And thank you very much for doing so and for your time being part of this LexisNexis podcast.
My pleasure. Happy to do so.
Thank you for listening to the LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Copyright 2010 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. Visit the LexisNexis communities at www.lexisnexis.com/community. LexisNexis, Total Practice Solutions. This is Steve Bursler. Thank you for listening.